Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 5, Discourse Number 8.
The first question. Bhagwan, I have tasted the fragrance and the nectar of the Buddha field while I have been here. How do we keep this with us whilst we are away, especially in the midst of anti-Buddha field forces? Jagdish Bharati, to experience the presence of the Divine is to be transformed so essentially that even if you want to lose it, you cannot lose it. It becomes part of your being. And more so when you will be surrounded by anti-Buddha field forces. It will crystallize there. The contrast is always helpful. The contrast cannot destroy it. It becomes a challenge. It is an opportunity. Never think it as a calamity. I send my sannyasins to the farthest corners of the earth. That is a device. Because when they go away, far away from me, they start relying more on their own awareness. They have to. They start being more spontaneous. They have to. They become more responsible. And each moment, they have to be alert, watchful. Because there are so many things to destroy their treasure. The very existence of the anti-forces becomes a constant challenge for them. It helps integration. So you need not be worried. The fragrance will remain with you. The nectar is already a part of your being. And while you will be in Chicago, you will find yourself closer to me than you can find here. Because here there are so many sannyasins. You are last in the many. There you will be alone. And you can relate to me more directly, more intimately. And the physical distance makes no difference at all. Love knows no distance. Then Chicago becomes a suburb of Pune. And whenever you will close your eyes, you will find me there. The right way to see me is to see me with closed eyes. With open eyes, you can see only the physical part of me. With the closed eyes, you can see the real me. A great Indian mystic, Paltu, has said something very strange. Nobody has ever said it. He has said that only those who are blind will be able to understand me. Only those who are blind will be able to see me who I am. A very strange statement. And when you think of other statements made by other mystics, for example, Jesus says, those who have ears, hear me. Those who have eyes, see me. Paltu says that only the blind ones can see me. He means that I can be seen only with closed eyes. When your eyes are open, your energy is moving in an extrovert way. And I am not there. You can find me only when your eyes are closed. Then in the deepest core of your being, at the innermost shrine, you will find me. That's how the disciple always finds the master. And that's how the disciple, in one sense, becomes absolutely devoted to the master. And in another sense becomes absolutely free of the master. Because when you have found the master within yourself, then there is no dependence on the outer master. Then the outer master was just a reflection of the inner. Hence people go on seeing in me what they want to see. They go on projecting. There are three kinds of meditators in the world. The first kind meditates with open eyes. There are methods of meditation which can be done only with open eyes. With open eyes, you relate with nature. The physical manifestation of God, with all its beauties, all its rejoicings, the birds singing, and the trees flowering, and the stars. With open eyes, you can see the manifest God. Hence, there are few techniques of meditation which have to be done with open eyes. And there are few techniques which have to be done with closed eyes. Then you see the unmanifest God, which is far more important. Because the manifestation is momentary and the unmanifested is eternal. I am here in the body. This is a momentary phenomenon. Tomorrow I may not be here in the physical body. My sannyasins have to learn, whether they are in Pune or Chicago, they have to learn to connect, to contact with me with closed eyes, then I am forever. Then whenever they will close their eyes, they will be surrounded by me. It will not be a form. It will not be a face. It will be simply fragrance. It will not be a flower, but only fragrance. You can catch hold of a flower, but you cannot catch hold of fragrance. You can experience it, but there is no way to keep it in your fist. You cannot touch it, but you can be moved, tremendously moved by it, transformed by it, transmuted by it. And there are few meditations which are done with half closed eyes and half open. Particularly Buddha insisted to do your meditation with half closed eyes and half open. Why? His path is the middle path in everything. He is a very consistent man. He says, be exactly in the middle. Because if you are outside with open eyes, you may become attached to the manifest world. If you are with closed eyes, you may become attached to the unmanifest world. But with half open and half closed eyes, you will remain detached from both. You will be just a watcher in the middle. On one side, the existence of nature, on another side, the existence of God, and you simply standing in the middle. That too is a way of meditation. My own suggestion is, first meditate with open eyes. Second, meditate with half open eyes and half closed eyes. Third, meditate with closed eyes. Slowly, slowly move into the unknown and the unknowable. Jagdish Bharati, you say, I have tasted the fragrance and the nectar of the Buddha field while I have been here. My effort is to make this whole earth a Buddha field. So wherever my sannyasins are, there is a mini Buddha field. And now you are one of my sannyasins. You will function there as a vehicle to me. Allow me to function through you. And a mini Buddha field will be created. Slowly, slowly, each of my sannyasin has to become a Buddha field. He has to carry around himself the aroma of enlightenment, of love, of prayer. He has to create a small climate that follows him wherever he goes. He has to remain in that small atmosphere of his own. Wherever he goes, it follows him like a shadow. Soon we are going to fill the whole earth with many, many sannyasins. And wherever a sannyasin is, there is an oasis. And a single sannyasin can trigger the process. And many more souls can be ignited, can be made aflame. And this is going to happen with you. I have seen in you a great potential. You can become a true vehicle to me. You can be a hollow bamboo, and I can sing the song. Now spread the fragrance and the nectar that you have tasted. What else we can give to our friends? What else we can give to our lovers, beloveds, our wives, husbands, children, parents? What more is there to give, or what is more precious than to give them a little taste of Buddhahood? Whatsoever you have tasted here, share it, and by sharing it will go on growing. In the inner world, the economics is totally different than in the outer. In the outer, if you share, you lose. Whatsoever you give is lost to you. In the inner world, whatsoever you cling is lost. Whatsoever you share is yours forever. Not only that it is yours forever, it is multiplied. Give more and you will have more. Go with great joy. You are carrying a treasure with you. You are a messenger. And you are carrying a message which is immensely needed by humanity today. It has always been needed, but never so much as today. Man has never been in such anguish before. Man has never been in such a despair before. Man has never felt so meaningless before. He needs people whose presence can make him feel again at ease, relaxed. Whose presence can give him a hope again that meaning is possible, that life can be lived in a totally new way, that there are new ways of life, new altitudes of life, that one need not remain empty. Then one can have a new kind of fullness which does not come by money, by power, by prestige, but comes only through a meditative awareness, a loving awareness. Go as my messenger. Spread whatsoever you have tasted here to as many people as possible. And you will see, the more you spread the message, the more and more deep-rooted you become in it. You will not lose contact. Don't be worried at all. I will be coming with you, following you. You will find me always very close to you. Yes, sometimes you can chit-chat with me. And if sometimes the idea arises to have a little dialogue with me, don't feel that it is crazy. Let the dialogue happen, and you will be surprised that your questions are answered in the same way that I am answering here. They will be answered from your own deepest recesses of being. They will be answered by your own center. The questions come from the circumference, and the answers come from the center. In the beginning, they will look as if I am answering you. But sooner or later, you will discover that they are being answered by your own real self. The Master represents only your real self. He speaks to you only to provoke the sleeping center of your being. Once the center is awake, the Master becomes silent with the disciple. There is a Sufi story about Bahauddin, one of the great Sufi mystics. He was living with his disciples, few hundred disciples, in the desert. Few travelers passing by thought, just out of curiosity to see what is happening. So they went to the monastery. They asked permission. They wanted just to see what is happening. And they could not believe their eyes. Thousands of people were looking crazy. Somebody was dancing, somebody was shouting, somebody was talking to the sky. And it was all chaos. They said, this man Bahauddin seems to be insane. And he had gathered all kinds of insane people here. What is going on? And Bahauddin was sitting just in the middle of it all. They went away to their destination. When they were coming back, again, out of curiosity, they thought, what is happening now? We should go and see. They went there. Bahauddin was still sitting in the same place, and all the disciples who were shouting and were looking crazy just few months before were all sitting in silence, as if there was no one. The monastery was so quiet. So utterly quiet. Now they were even more puzzled. What has happened? Where all that insanity and chaos has gone? Not a single word was uttered by Bahauddin. Not a question was asked by the disciples. The spectators remained there for a few minutes and then they went away. After a few years, again, they were passing by and they said, now let us see what is happening. They went there. Bahauddin was still sitting in the middle and there was not a single disciple around. The whole monastery was empty. Now they could not contain their curiosity. More so because Bahauddin was alone, they thought, why not ask him? So they asked, first we came few years before, they said, it was all hell loose. And we thought that you are mad and your followers are mad. What was happening at that time? Bahauddin says, catharsis. They were throwing out their insanities that they have gathered in many, many lives because of you people, because of a repressive society, because of an insane society. I was allowing them to throw it out, to get rid of it. Then the people asked, then what happened when we came back? They were all silent. Bahauddin said, they threw all that was in and nothing was left. They became sane. Hence they were sitting in silence. Those people said, we can understand these two things, but what happened now? Where are all they gone? Bahauddin said, now they have gone to spread the message. Now there is no more to do for them. They have tasted the nectar. Now they have gone to the farthest corner of the earth to bring more crazy people. And next time when you come, you will again find the same thing happening. Crazy people throwing out all their craziness. Jagdish is a professor of psychology in Chicago. Go there and bring as many insane people as you can. Help my work. And to help my work is to be with me. To help my work is real intimacy with me. And I will be constantly watching you. Remember it, wherever you are, that I am with you. And soon, it will not be just an idea. It becomes a reality. It is a reality. Just you have to discover it. And the anti-Buddha field forces are going to help you immensely. Because of those anti-Buddha field forces, you will become more crystallized. You will become more centered, more rooted. This is part of the process of growth, to send you again and again into the marketplace. The second question, Bhagwan, you talk so much about the witness, but what is the witness and what is the judge? How can we tell which is which? The witness or the judge? Deva Bhumika. It is very simple. The distinction is very clear. It is impossible to be confused about it. The judge is always judging, saying this is good, this is not good, this is virtue, this is sin, this is moral, this is immoral, this should be and this should not be. The judge is continuously judging. A thought passes in the mind and immediately the judge says, this is not good to have such a thought. This is a bad thought, evil. Or the judge says, it is a beautiful thought. Cherish it, nourish it, treasure it. It is very precious. The judge is always making judgments, for or against. It has a priori ideas of what is right and what is wrong. The judge is given to you by the society. Hence, there are different judges in you. A Christian has a different judge than a Hindu. I have heard a woman went to swimming in the sea, went too far, was drowned, was pulled out of the sea by the guards. They tried every effort to revive her, but it was too late. So they had to leave her body there, and they went to the nearest phone to inform their office that a woman has died. It happened somewhere on the French coast. When they came back, they were surprised. A Frenchman was making love to the dead woman. She said, "What are you doing? Are you mad or something? The woman is dead." The Frenchman said, "My God, I thought she is Catholic." Now a Catholic woman is not expected to enjoy or to move or to shriek with joy or to shout Alleluia. No, not at all. She has to lie down there absolutely dead. Only bad women make any kinds of movements. Good women, never. They simply lie down there. They simply suffer. A Catholic has a different conscience, hence a different judge. A Hindu has a different conscience, hence a different judge. The Jaina has a different conscience, hence a different judge. And the conscience is created by the society. The judge is in the service of the society. From the very childhood we start teaching the children what is right and what is wrong. And by and by, they imbibe it. They imitate it. It becomes part of their conditioning. The judge is in the service of the society in which you have been brought up. Hence, there are as many judges as there are cultures, societies, religions, ideologies. But the witness is one. There is not any difference between a Christian and a Hindu or a Buddhist. The witness is one. Witness is not given to you by the society. It is awakening of your soul. It is awareness. By being a witness is meant that you don't condemn. You don't appreciate either. You don't evaluate at all. You don't say anything, you simply see. A thought passes inside your mind, you simply see, mirror-like. You don't say good, bad, you don't label it. You simply see, it is coming in, it is in front of you, it is going out. You don't make any comment, what it is. A witness is a pure mirror-like consciousness. Judges are different, but the witness is one. If the Christian becomes a witness, he will be the same as the Hindu when he becomes a witness. That's why Buddha and Jesus and Moses and Muhammad are not different. They are witnesses. But the Mohammedan, the Christian, the Buddhist, the Jew, they are different. They live through the given ideology by the society. And the society has its own interests. And you can be given very stupid ideas, and you will carry those ideas your whole life. Unless you make great effort to awake yourself, you will remain enclosed in your ideologies. They will dominate you. This is a social strategy to dominate you. Not only they have placed the policemen outside and the magistrates and the government inside also, they have interfered with your being. Inside also the society has trespassed you. The judge simply shows the trespass of the society. If we are to create a better humanity, we have to drop creating judges. We have to help people to be conscious. Don't give conscience to people, just give them consciousness. And their consciousness has to be decisive about their life. Then they have to act out of their own awareness, not by given commandments. Not by given rules by others. That is the way of slavery. That's how we have existed up to now. My effort here is to help you to drop your conscience. That's why all the religions are against me. It is natural. On one point they agree. In India, the Christians, the Hindus, the Jainas, the Buddhists, the Mohammedans, they are all agreeing on one point, that I am a dangerous man, that people should be prevented from approaching me, that great barriers should be created so that nobody can come under my influence, because to them it seems evil influence. Just the other day I saw one Italian magazine with my picture on the front cover. I loved it. My picture with two horns. That's how I must be appearing to the Vatican Pope. That's how I appear to the Shankaracharyas. That's how I appear to the Jaina monks. It is natural. I appear them to be the most dangerous person. And the reason? Because whatsoever they have created, I am trying to destroy it. Because to me, they have created only bondage for you. They have created chains for you, subtle prison cells for you. The conscience is the most subtle slavery. Live through consciousness, not through conscience. Be so alert that you can take responsibility of your own life. Witnessing is totally different from being a judge. Witnessing is simple. You come before the mirror. Whether you are beautiful or ugly, the mirror makes no comment. It simply mirrors you. That's all. Whatsoever you are, with no comment, with no judgment. It does not say, you are ugly, get lost. Or you are beautiful, remain here a little longer. I enjoy you. I enjoy your company. A witness becomes a mirror. He goes on watching. And the miracle is, if you can watch your mind without becoming a judge, you will go beyond mind very soon. It is your judgments which create entanglements with the mind. One thing you like and you cling to it, and one thing you dislike and you want to push it away. You become entangled. You get involved with the mind. You become identified with the mind. And you don't know what is truth. And you don't know what is good. And you don't know what is beauty. All that you know is borrowed. All that you know is what the society has told you. And the society is repeating for centuries, and it goes on repeating the same things. The society is not enlightened. There has not yet been an enlightened society. Only enlightened individuals. You can become enlightened by becoming more conscious, more of a witness. Be less of a judge. And you will be surprised when you become a witness and you don't judge yourself, you stop judging others too. And that makes you more human, more compassionate, more understanding. The man who judges himself continuously is bound to judge others too. Even more so. He will be cruel. He will be hard on others. If he condemns himself for something, he will condemn others even more. He will always be looking for faults. He will never be able to see the glory of your being. He will become too much concerned with trifles, with trivia. He will become too much concerned with your small acts. If he finds a Buddha sipping tea, he will become more concerned about tea than about the Buddha. He will say, Buddha and sipping tea? You will be surprised. There are people. For example, Mahatma Gandhi, he was against tea. It is a sin. It was a sin in his ashram. If somebody was found drinking tea, great fuss was made about it. Once he himself went for 3 days fast to purify himself, because one of his disciples has been drinking tea. He punished himself. That is a very subtle and cunning way to punish somebody. Just think, if you do something and I go for a fast for 3 days. That will be a great torture for you. You will not be able to sleep those 3 days. It will be heavy on you. You will think again and again, why I did such a thing. The master is suffering. And he is purifying himself. Why? Because he says, if I was really pure, then no disciple can do anything which is wrong. How can a disciple do anything wrong if the master is absolutely pure? That was his arithmetic. So he will punish himself. Punishing himself is a kind of masochism. But it works. It works better than punishing others. Because the people who have gathered around such a person love him. That's why they have gathered around him. Now for such a small thing, but he has created great clamor about tea or about smoking. In his ashram, nobody could smoke, nobody could drink tea. What to say about wine? If he had met Jesus, he would have condemned him immediately. He would have gone at least for a 3 months fast to purify himself and to help Jesus, because he used to drink wine. The best wine was always created by Christian monasteries. In their cellars, they have the oldest wine, the best. Now, this must have been inconceivable to Mahatma Gandhi. A man like Jesus drinking wine. But Buddhists have been drinking tea down the ages, and there is no problem. In fact, they have made in Japan it a great ceremony. They drink tea so meditatively that each Zen monastery has a special temple. Yes, it is called temple, where they go to drink tea. You can't enter in the temple with the shoes on. You can't talk in the temple where you drink tea. And there is a special process. And the whole thing is so meditative that the guests will come silently, they will sit in a meditative posture. The host, usually a woman, will prepare tea. And the aroma of the tea, and the samovar, and the sound and the music of it, and everybody will be silently sitting and listening to the sound of the samovar, and everybody will be smelling the beautiful perfume of the tea, and they are getting ready. As the tea is getting ready, they are getting ready, becoming more silent, more quiet. Then the tea is served. in beautiful, very aesthetic cups and saucers, especially made, handmade, so they can be unique. And then people will drink tea, not as people do on railway stations. One sip and then they look back at the train. Then another and then they look at the back at the train. Somehow they are to swallow it and run and catch the train, and the train may be gone. Not like that. Sitting silently for hours, sipping tea slowly. There is no hurry. It is meditation. Now I would like that Zen people are really doing something beautiful than Mahatma Gandhi. The real art is to transform the mundane into sacred. That is the touch of a master. He touches dust and it becomes gold. Now tea is transformed into prayer. This is beauty. This is alchemy. Now tea drinking becomes a witnessing, watchfulness. But if you are prejudiced against something, and everybody is prejudiced, the whole world is prejudiced in one way or the other. And I am here to destroy all your prejudices, all that has been implanted in you. It has to be taken out. You have to be made again pure, childlike, pure, innocent, not knowing what is wrong and what is right, just witnessing. Out of that witnessing, a response arises, a response which is total, because your whole heart is behind it. A response which is total, because it is your own response, not a repetition of somebody else's teachings. A response for which you will never regret. A response will not make you feel guilty that I have done something wrong. And will not make you feel egoistic that I have done something great. A response is a simple response. It neither makes you feel inferior nor superior. It was simply the requirement of the moment. It came out of your witnessing and it is finished. It leaves no trace behind. The witnessing soul is like the sky. The birds fly in the sky, but they don't leave any footmarks. That's what Buddha says. That the man who is awakened lives in such a way that he leaves no footmarks. He is without wounds and without scars. He never looks back. There is no point. He has lived that moment so totally that what is the need of looking back again and again? He never looks ahead, he never looks back, he lives in the moment. Judgment comes from the past, and witnessing is a present consciousness. Witnessing is now and here, and judgment is somewhere else in the past. Whenever you judge anything, try a small experiment. Try to find out who has given you this idea. And if you go deeply into it, you will be surprised. You can even hear your mother saying it, or your father, or your teacher in the school. You can hear their voices still there, resounding in your memory. But it is not yours. And whatsoever is not yours is ugly. And whatsoever is yours is beautiful. It has grace. The third question, Bhagwan, why do you tell so many jokes about the Jews? Sanatano, Jews have the sense of humor as nobody else has it. For example, Hindus have no jokes. Not a single joke which can be called Hindu. All the jokes that Indians tell to each other come from the West. India has lost the sense of humor. It has become too serious. Jews could not become too serious for the simple reason their life for centuries has been that of great suffering. It is humor that helped them to survive. They had to create great sense of humor. India has lived in a lukewarm way. It has not suffered much. Nobody has tortured it much. Nobody was bent upon to destroy it. It never needed the sense of humor to save itself from seriousness. On the contrary, because life has been simple, without much suffering and pain, people have become serious. Jews have the best jokes in the world. You will be surprised that this is my observation, that it is their sense of humor that has saved them. Otherwise they would have been destroyed long before. They had to create a great sense of humor. Even in the concentration camps of Adolf Hitler, they were joking. That was their way of remaining alive. And I love jokes. Hence I love Jews too. Two Jews met each other for the first time. Where are you from? Miami Beach, Florida. Answered the other. Where are you from? Lincoln, Nebraska. Answered the other. What is the population of Miami Beach? About 100,000 people. And how many Jews are there? About 90,000. And what do they do for a living? They are doctors, advocates, magistrates, accountants, retired wealthy men, bankers, etc., etc. And tell me about the other 10,000 people. What do? They are policemen, carpenters, laborers, etc. So now you tell me about Lincoln, Nebraska. What is the population there? About 300,000 people. And how many of them are our people? I guess there are about 5,000 Jews. Wow, said the other. How come you need so many servants? Jews are intelligent people. They snatch away more Nobel Prizes than anybody else. That intelligence is also there because they have suffered long and they have to find always new ways to survive. Intelligence arises when it is challenged. Intelligence arises, becomes sharpened when it is used. If it is not used, it gathers dust. When it is not used, when there is no need to use it, it dies. It is like if you don't use your legs for ears, you will lose them. You will not be able to walk again. It is like if you keep your eyes for 3 years closed, you will lose your eyesight. Thieves have better eyesight than anybody else, naturally, because they have to look into dark, into other people's houses. Maybe they have entered in the house for the first time. They don't know. Where is the door and where is the wall and how the furniture is arranged? Still, they have to walk silently. They start getting better eyesight than anybody. You will not find a thief with glasses. At least I have not found yet. So whenever you see a person without glasses, beware. Who knows? Keep watch. A man with eyeglasses, you need not worry about him. He cannot even find his own things. How he can find your things? Impossible. He cannot find things in his own house. Jews have lived really a long, long, arduous life because of the Christians. The whole idea is absurd. Because once Jesus was crucified, Jews need not be tortured forever and ever. And the Jews you are torturing have not crucified Jesus. Those people are gone. But that's how foolish prejudices continue. And particularly Christians, go on and on repeating the same thing. The sin that was committed by Adam and Eve is still heavy on them. Now if Adam and Eve committed it, they will suffer for it. Why you are worried? You have not committed it. But they think, it is in your blood. It has come to you because you are in the same chain, in the same continuity. This is absurd.
utterly absurd. Buddha had a son. Mahavira had a daughter. The daughter must have given birth to few children. Where are they? Mahavira is not carried. Where is Zarathustra's nor Adam and Eve are carried by blood cells. It is utterly stupid to torture Jews for something that happened 2,000 years before. But it continues. In a way, it has been a blessing in disguise. It is a curse, but it has given Jews a sharpness, a brilliance, an intelligence, a sense of humor. They can laugh even when they are facing death. I have heard that in concentration camps, they survived not on food because food was not enough. They survived on jokes. Even going into the oven, into the gas chamber, they were going telling jokes to each other, laughing. A beautiful people. Christians don't joke about their bishops and popes. Hindus never against their mahatmas. Impossible. Jews joke even about their rabbis. More about rabbis than about anybody else they joke. That shows intimacy. That shows love and respect, remember. That shows that the rabbi is not something of an outsider. He is an insider. There was a function in a Jewish community. They were raising money for the synagogue. The synagogue was in a bad condition. So they had sold tickets for a lottery. And now the day has come when the first three prizes were going to be distributed. A man was called and declared that he has got the third prize. A Lincoln Continental, a beautiful car, was there on the stage. That was the third prize. Then the man was called who had got the second prize. He was given just a big cake. He was hoping that he may be given an aeroplane or something. The third prize is a Lincoln Continental and the second prize is a cake. He said to the man who was distributing, "Are you mad? But the man said, "You don't understand. The cake is prepared by the rabbi's wife herself." The man was so angry, he said, "Fuck the rabbi's wife." And the man said, "But that is the third prize. The first prize." That is the first prize. Only Jews can joke this way. That shows intimacy. That shows respect, love. The rabbi is part of the community. Three men were hurt in an aeroplane crash in Africa and were recuperating in a Moroccan hospital. In Morocco, they allow the shepherds to bring their flocks into town to graze, which helps to keep the grass short. One day, one of the three, a Christian confined to their hospital rooms for several months, looked out a window. There was a flock of sheep enjoying lunch. The Christian pointed to a plump ewe and exclaimed, "I wish that one was Elizabeth Taylor." The second, who was a Mohammedan, said, "I wish that was Raquel Welch." And the third, who was a Jew, said, "I just wish it was dark." The fifth question. Bhagwan, you once said that acting is the most spiritual of professions, and now we have a theater group. Can you say something about acting? Krishna Prem. Acting is certainly the most spiritual of professions. For the simple reason that the actor has to be in a paradox. He has to become identified with the act he is doing and yet remain a watcher. If he is acting as Hamlet, he has to become absolutely involved in being a Hamlet. He has to forget himself totally into his act. And yet, at the deepest core of his being, he has to remain a spectator, a watcher. If he really becomes absolutely identified with Hamlet, then there is bound to be trouble. In India, the most popular scripture of the Hindus is Ramayana, the story of Rama. It is played all over the country every year. It has been played for thousands of years, and every village has its own small theater group to play Ram Leela. In Ram Leela, Rama is one of the characters, the incarnation of God. and Ravana, his opposite, the incarnation of devil. The fight is between light and darkness. It is a parable. Rama gets married to Sita, one of the most beautiful women of those days. In those days, marriages were not arranged. They were called Swayamvaras. Swayamvara means the woman was free to choose, and the women, particularly from the royal families, used to make conditions. Those people who will fulfill these conditions will be entitled to be chosen. The condition that Sita has made was a great bow of Shiva. Anybody who can break the bow with his bare hands will be chosen. Now the bow of Shiva was of such strength and made of such steel that nobody can even bow it down with his bare hands, what to say about breaking it into pieces. All the princes of the country had gathered. Rama came too, and Ravana also. Ravana was the king of Ceylon, and there was great fear in the camp of Sita's father, because they did not want Ravana to win the contest. And there was every possibility, because he was the most strong man of those days. And he was also a devotee of Shiva. And his devotion was such that once Shiva has appeared to him and told him, "You can ask anything and I will give it to you." Ravana had 10 heads. A beautiful metaphor. 10 faces everybody has. Who can have only single face? Only a Buddha. The original face. Otherwise everybody has many faces. You need one face with your wife, another face with your mistress. You can't function with the same face with the both. You need one face with your servant, another face for your boss. If the servant and the boss are both present, when you look at the left at the servant, you show him one face. And when you look to the right to your boss, you show him another face. You start smiling and wagging your tail. It was said that Ravana had 10 faces. He asked Shiva, "Give me this blessing, that if one of my head is cut, immediately another will grow. And I will always have 10 heads, never less than that." And Shiva has blessed him. Such a devotee of Shiva and such a powerful man that you cannot cut his head, immediately it grows again. There was fear, great fear of his powers. He may win the contest. And Janaka, the father of Sita, was really in great anxiety. Something has to be done. So a conspiracy was done. When all the princes and the kings gathered and the contest was going to happen and the bow was brought, a false messenger comes running to Ramana and says, "What are you doing here? Your country is on fire. Ceylon is burning." So he rushed immediately to Ceylon. Meanwhile, Rama won the contest, was married to Sita. This is the story. Now, in a village it happened, the play was being played. And when the messenger comes and says to Ramana, "Your country is on fire," he said, "Let it be. I don't care. This time I am going to win Sita. Enough is enough." In fact, the woman who was acting as Sita, this man has always loved her deep down in his heart. He forgot completely the play. He became utterly identified. It became a reality. And he rose. Now it was not Shiva's real bow. Just a village carpenter has made it. He broke it in so many pieces and threw it away. Before anybody could prevent him. And he said to Janak, "Now, where is Sita? Now what to do with such a man?" And the whole audience was simply shocked. Now he is finishing the whole story, because there is no more to it. The whole story depends on that Ramana is avoided, Rama gets married, and then they struggle. Then Ramana steals Sita. And the war, and the whole thing happens, but if Ramana marries, then finished. Within 2 minutes, it is just the beginning, the first scene. And the man who had become Ramana was the most strong man of the village, naturally. And Rama was just a boy. He could crush Rama any moment. For a moment there was utter silence. But Janaka, the father of Sita, was an old man, an experienced man, has played the role many times. He said, "It seems that my servants have brought a wrong bow. This is not the real bow. Drop the curtain and bring the real bow." The curtain was dropped. 10 people had to carry Ramana out. But he was shouting and people could hear that, "Where is Sita? This time I am not going to lose." Somehow tranquilizers were given to him. He was put to sleep, otherwise he may come back again and create trouble. And another man had to play the role. He became too much identified. He forgot that this is just a play. the real actor has to live a paradox. He has to act as if he is what he is acting, and yet deep down he knows that I am not this. That's why I say acting is the most spiritual of professions. The real spiritual person transforms his whole life in an acting. Then this whole earth is just a stage. And all the people are nothing but actors. And we are enacting a play. Then if you are a beggar, you play your act as beautifully as you can. And if you are the king, you play your act as beautifully as you can. But deep down the beggar knows, I am not it. And the king too knows, I am not it. If the beggar and the king both know that what I am doing and acting is just acting, it is not me, not my reality, then both are arriving at the very center of their being, all I call witnessing. Then they are doing certain acts and witnessing too. So acting is certainly Krishna Prem, the most spiritual profession, and all spiritual persons are nothing but actors. The whole earth is their stage, and the whole life is nothing but a drama enacted. The sixth question, Bhagwan, it seems that nobody understands me except you. I have been to the psychoanalysts, but they also seem not to understand me. Why and how do you manage to understand all kinds of people? Gatha. The most fundamental secret is that I never try to understand them at all. I simply look at them. I love them. I accept them as they are. The very effort of understanding the other person is to reduce him into an object of inquiry. It is immoral. He becomes an object. And to reduce a person into an object is the most ugly thing you can do to anybody. Who are you to understand the other? Understand yourself. Because there, the object and the subject are one. The observer and the observed are one. There, the knower and the known are one. But how can you know the other? You can love. And through love, this miracle happens. If you love the other, great understanding arises on its own. Not that you try to understand the other. You simply love the other as he is, with no judgment. The psychoanalyst cannot understand you, Gatha, because he has his own judgments. Before you start saying anything, he has already judged you by the way you walk in, the way you sit in the chair. He is watching you. He has learned all these strategies, the body language. He has already reduced you into an object. He will not allow love to happen, he is already far away, an inquirer, a scientific inquirer. You are a guinea pig. He has insulted you, offended you. It is said that a psychoanalyst is a person who looks at others when a beautiful woman comes in. He does not look at the beautiful woman. He looks at others, how they are feeling about the beautiful woman, what they are thinking about the beautiful woman. His whole interest is to penetrate the mystery of people. Why and how he wants to reduce everything into manipulatable knowledge. And the moment you lie down on the couch of a psychoanalyst, he is reducing you even below humanity. In fact, when you lie down on the couch, you lose much. Lying down on the couch is a good posture for sleep. You become more prone to unconsciousness. You become indefensible, vulnerable. And the psychiatrist or the psychoanalyst stands behind a curtain so that his presence does not keep you alert. He wants you to become as unalert as possible. So in your unalertness, you can blurt out many things which you would not have said to anybody else. He wants to poke into your unconscious. He wants to unlock you. He is treating you as if you are a machine. And then immediately he labels that this is inferiority complex, that this is schizophrenia, that this is neurosis, that this is psychosis. You are removed away. Now he will treat the label that he has given to you. He does not relate with the person. He relates with the labels. He cannot understand you. In fact, he does not understand even himself. And the first requirement to understand anybody in this world is to understand yourself. If you understand yourself, you will never try to understand anybody. You will love, you will accept, and your acceptance and love will be unconditional. My love to you is unconditional. I make no condition. I don't give you a certain discipline to follow. I want you to be yourself, totally yourself. I give you absolute freedom to be yourself. I support you in every possible way so that you can be independent. The psychoanalyst is not really making you independent. He makes you more and more dependent. So the psychoanalysis goes on prolonging for years and years. And when you get tired from one psychoanalyst, you have to go to another. It becomes your style of life from going one psychoanalyst to another. And these psychoanalysts are in the same misery as you are. They are not different people. They can't be. Because only one thing makes the difference. That is love. And that is missing. Only one thing transforms a person, and that is meditation, and that is missing. Sigmund Freud knew nothing of meditation. All is intellectual analysis. He was really afraid of meditation. Afraid into falling in some uncharted sea, unfathomable. Analysis is within your hands. It is a mind thing. The psychoanalyst is in the same boat as you are. A disillusioned man finds his way to a psychiatrist. When he is called in, he explains, "Everybody neglects me. It is as if I am not there at all. As if I am the air. They just don't notice me. They." The psychiatrist stands up, walks gently to the door and opens it saying, "Next patient, please." He is not different from you. Knowledgeable he is, certainly. But wise he is not. He suffers from the same problems, the same anger, jealousy, possessiveness as you suffer. Even the greatest of psychoanalysts, like Reich, one of the greatest of this century, his wife has written memoirs about Reich. He talks too much of how to get rid of jealousy. He talks too much of freedom in sex. And as far as he himself was concerned, he moved with many women. But he never allowed his wife to have any freedom. He was so suspicious and so possessive that he will open all the letters written to his wife, and he will keep an eye. He will tell children to keep a note who comes when he is not at home. Now this man talks about getting rid of jealousy, possessiveness, and really he was a great intellectual, but as far as his own life is concerned, he behaves in the same way. And many are the followers of Reich. They will go on repeating him, never knowing the real person. The wife of a well-known psychoanalyst was entertaining a number of guests one evening. During one point in the party, her 10-year-old son flitted into the room, arrayed in a strapless black evening gown, his lips covered with lipstick, high-heeled suede shoes on his feet, and a feathered hat on his head. Quite naturally, the woman was stunned. "Rodney," she cried, "you naughty, naughty boy, go upstairs and remove your father's clothes before he comes in and catches you." They cannot understand you. In fact, nobody can understand you except an enlightened person. A Buddha, a Jesus, a Lao Tzu, but not Freud, Jung, Adler. They cannot understand. They don't have that light in their being yet. They cannot shower that light on you. They are not really authentic people. They are as inauthentic as you are. And as foolish and as stupid as you are. During a beautiful walk in the Himalayas, a father who was a famous psychoanalyst suddenly hears his son scream as he falls into a deep ravine. "Johnny," he cries desperately, "don't move. I will get a rope to pull you out." A few hours later, he returns with a rope. Throwing it down, he cries, "Johnny, boy, grab the rope. Daddy, I have got no hands anymore," was the answer from the deep down. "Use your teeth. Bite strongly on the rope and I will pull you up." Slowly, slowly, meter by meter, Johnny is pulled up. When only the last few meters remain, the father calls, "Johnny, is everything all right?" Enough for today.